You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's NL East beat reporters. Talking Atlanta Braves with Mark Bowman. We'll be taking a look at the Andrelton Simmons trade, the Freddie Freeman rumors, and we're talking a lot about messaging and what the Braves front office is conveying to its fans. Talking Marlins with Joe Fusaro, we'll be taking a look at those Jose Fernandez rumors, not just trade rumors, but some rumors about Fernandez's relationship with the club, and also whether they might trade Marcelo Ozuna, including possibly for a closer. We'll talk New York Mets with Anthony DiComo, taking a look at how the Mets find a way to add the bats they need and the possibility that they might wait a little while to add the bat or bats they need. Talking Phillies with Todd Zielecki, taking a look at whether they might pursue some big-time, big-dollar free agents and also whether they might trade Ken Giles. And talking Washington Nationals with Bill Ladson, taking a look at the Dusty Baker hire as well as Dusty Baker's coaching staff and what the Nationals might do in the hot stove season. Been a lot of rumors surrounding the Mets already because for a very good team coming off a great year, they actually have quite a few questions. It seems like the name that is coming up the most and is sort of the most intriguing and probably to Mets fans the most exciting is Ben Zobrist. And you addressed this situation in an inbox this week and sort of broke down the pros and cons and why he'd be appealing and why the Mets might say no. What's your read? Is there real momentum to this? Is it just kind of, as we say a lot this time of year, kicking the tires? What's your understanding on kind of where that's at?
I think momentum might be a little strong. Certainly he's a guy that they really like, and if you sort of mapped out the free agent landscape and looked at all the guys who might fit, who could fit, who they should and will pursue, Zobrist is pretty much at the top of the list. He checks a lot of their boxes. They love his bat. They've liked him for a long time. They love his ability to get on base. And what they really like is the Mets, you know, losing Daniel Murphy, they don't want to go out and get an everyday second base type, like Howie Kendrick, for example. They don't want that guy because they have Dilson Herrera, who is pretty much big league ready at this point. They want him to get some play, and they don't want to block him fully. So if you get a guy like Zobrist, who has this unique versatility, I think it helps them in a lot of ways. And more than Murphy, because Murphy was a versatile guy as well, but he can only play the infield. Zobrist can play the outfield, which the Mets love, because then you can sub him for Curtis Granderson or Michael Conforto in the corners on days when they're facing a tough left-handed pitcher. Zobrist is great against lefties. And all of that goes into it. So on paper, it's just a terrific match for the Mets. Now, the problem is that because Zobrist is so well thought of and so versatile and so well-liked throughout the game, he's got 8, 10, 12 teams that are going to be in on him and going to be at least seriously considering him, if not seriously pursuing him. Sandy Alderson does not like getting in bidding wars. He's never gotten in one as general manager of the Mets, and the Mets really have shown no indication that they're going to raise their payroll all that much. So when push comes to shove, I think it's going to be tough for the Mets to actually acquire Ben Zobrist. I think they're certainly going to try, but I also think they have some plan Bs and Cs and maybe even D through Z in place in case it doesn't work out, because it's going to be a very competitive market for this guy, and as much as the Mets like him, they ultimately might not be able to get him.
And that really kind of leads to what I think is the big question here, and somewhat amusingly, it's kind of the same big question that there's been for who knows how long, which is, what do they do to ensure that they have, if not a dominant offense, at least an offense in 2016 that is, again, good enough to pair with this rotation and win something? I mean, Daniel Murphy is not a great player, but he's a good hitter. And if he's not back, he'll be missed. Cespedes will certainly be missed if he goes elsewhere. So what do they do to make sure that this is not the offense that struggled through much of the first half of last season?
Yeah, I think there's a real fear of that. In addition to the guys they're losing, you know, you've got Curtis Granderson, who is probably their MVP this year, is going to be 35 years old, I believe. And he's at an age where you can expect some regression, and you just hope he doesn't drop off a cliff. David Wright, you can't count on his health. Michael Kadire gave you essentially nothing last year. Juan Lagares had a really disappointing year, and so on and so forth. So with the exception of only a few guys, and really Michael Conforto is the one guy who you could look at in the offense and say, well, this guy we expect to be significantly better than he was this year, playing every day, being productive every day as a second-year player. You know, it's a tricky spot for them. They need to improve, and when you look at the things they're trying to do, acquire a middle infielder, maybe shore up that situation, acquire a lefty-hitting center fielder to pair with Juan Lagares, maybe even platoon with him, maybe take a lot of his playing time. Even if you accomplish those goals, I'm not sure it makes you that really good offensive team that they were in the second half of this season. So I think the Mets are going to try and get creative. I think they're going to look to get creative with a trade. There are some things they could do with the middle infield. We saw at the trade deadline that they're willing to shop Wilmer Flores, for example. They've talked about shopping Zach Wheeler, even though it's something that they don't particularly want to do. If the right deal came along, I think the Mets are going to explore all of those avenues. You know, the one thing they're not going to do is trade one of those top four starting pitchers, but everyone else, for the most part, seems like fair game. So I think if the Mets have an opportunity to do something like that, particularly in regards to the middle infield, where, you know, you don't really know still what you're getting with Wilmer Flores. Certainly you don't know what's going on with second base at this point, as much as the team does like Dilson Herrera. I think there's some opportunities for the Mets to get creative, and I think they're going to pursue every last one of them.
Well, we haven't done one of these in a while, so I wanted to start by talking about a topic that's a few weeks old, but I still think it's interesting, which is the hire of Dusty Baker. And you know, when he was first announced as a candidate, I kind of had some of the same reaction. I think a lot of people, a lot of the internet snarksters, of whom I am sometimes one, did, which is, really, this guy? And the more I thought about it, the more I warmed up to it. I actually think he might be a really good fit for this particular roster. What's your read on the, putting aside the process, which was admittedly strange, what's your read on the fit of Dusty Baker for the 2016 Nationals?
Matthew, he's what I call a player's manager. I look at it this way. Will he get along with Jason Worth? The answer is yes. Can he get along with Anthony Rendon? Can he get along with Bryce Harper? I think those are key guys, the players I mentioned. Those are the key guys that I think Dusty Baker has to really get along with, and I think without question he will get along with them. I mean, he has this reputation of being a player's manager, and I think it will be no different with the Washington Nationals. The bottom line is, though, he has to win, and that's the key.
Right. I think you kind of touched on, I think really the reason I have come around so much and the reason I think this is potentially such a good fit is that this is not only a team with very high expectations, it's a team with some really big personalities and some guys, a lot of guys who, even if they get along with each other, a lot of guys who kind of see themselves, I think, as alpha dog. I mean, whether Bryce Harper does or not, he's the guy. He's the best player in the National League. You've said many times Jason Worth is very much a leader in there. You know, Ryan Zimmerman, who is not known as a big personality guy, is the franchise. You know, it's got to be tough for him even now to sort of see other people as the face of the franchise. And so, to me, what's interesting and what makes Baker potentially such a good fit is that not only is he a player's manager, as you know, but he's handled the biggest personalities and the biggest egos in the game, and he's made it work. If you can make Barry Bonds and Jeff Kent work, you can make anybody work. So I guess the question here is, do you think that was a part of the thought process, that even if this is a very good clubhouse, it's a challenging clubhouse, and it's something that maybe, again, a rookie manager was a little out of his depth and maybe a guy who that kind of experience was needed?
I think there's no question about it. He was needed, and I think getting along, I think you said it best. I think getting along with Jeff Kent and Barry Bonds and getting along with Sammy Sosa and Joey Votto, I think that was big for the Nationals, and I think that was the reason Baker was hired. And to me, again, you have big personalities there. Bryce Harper, Jason Worth, and I think it will be smooth sailing. It will be an easy transition for those guys, and I see it really going well with Dusty Baker. But, again, it comes down to winning, and they have to win.
I think the other interesting part of all this is that they've assembled something of an all-star coaching staff. I mean, Mike Maddux is, by acclamation, one of the best pitching coaches in the game. Davey Lopes is an exceptional base-running coach. How much of a part of the overall strategy do you think was getting those kind of guys, not just the manager, but getting a coaching staff that seems to be really exceptional.
I think that was the plan all along, to tell you the truth. Mike Maddux, all Mike Grizzo was talking about when he came to hiring Mike Maddux was how he can, you know, figure out mechanics. He kept using the word mechanics all the time when talking about Mike Maddux. Davey Lopes, you know, I covered him in 2006 when he was the coach of the Nationals. And, you know, I didn't realize his strength until he went to the Phillies. And then I realized that the Nationals really missed him. And having him back, I think, is a great move because base running-wise, this team was really bad in terms of the base running. Stealing bases wasn't very good. So they'll improve there. And, you know, they also have Chris Fire as well, who was with Baker in Chicago and in Cincinnati. So it should be really a smooth transition for the players.
Mark, I bet you think that at some point, somewhere down the line, you're going to get a little bit of a break and your team will stop making news. We don't know if that's correct yet, but you got to think at some point they will stop making news. But they haven't yet.
Yeah, I mean, everything points to 2017, so it's probably somewhere around then. 2017, 18,
19. Yeah, somewhere.
Last year it was the move-a-day Braves. Maybe that was last winter. This year there's a rumor a day Braves. So, but like you said, they've kept things very interesting so far.
And it's only November. they made a really interesting move not all that long ago, certainly since the last time we talked on this. Traded Andrelton Simmons, which was one of the guys that it seemed like they wouldn't move. Not that it was a given, not that there was no way, and you know, one of the things we hear more and more executives saying this winter is, look, nobody's untouchable for the right move. And Sean Newcomb was certainly a heck of a haul and wasn't the only part. I mean, they made a nice move there. But I think for a lot of fans, this move was – tipping point's probably the wrong word, but this move kind of – for a lot of fans seems like kind of changed their perspective on this whole process. What was the Braves thinking here in being willing to part with Simmons, a guy who they had signed for a very long time, a guy who's still young, in order to continue this, again, they're not using the word rebuilding, but this restructuring of the roster?
Yeah, it's from their perspective, they saw, like everyone else, they understand Andrelton Simmons is the best defensive shortstop in the game. They understand the value that comes to this glove. On a nightly basis. They saw a guy who they did not know where he was going offensively. The odd part about that take is, he increased his on-base percentage and his batting average this year. Kevin Seitzer felt like he was making great strides. So, you know, that was one perspective of this trade that it caught me by surprise because I thought, you know, at the age of 26 that Simmons was maybe never going to get back to that guy. It was a 17-homer guy in 2013. But if he could be that 270 with a OBP of 320, 330 with that kind of glove, then all of a sudden that the money that he was going to be paid over the next few years, you were going to look at it as fair value for the team. Now, that money at the end of this contract is weighed heavily into this decision as well because the Braves took a step back and said, you know, we do not feel comfortable paying him $11 million in 18, $13 million in 19, and $15 million in 20. They looked at those dollar figures and said, hey, look, if he never starts to hit and his glove declines from a, you know, because just as a guy gets older, you're thinking his defense might decline. They were afraid of, you know, how bad that contract might look at that point in time, which – is interesting because this contract was just signed a couple years ago now. And in some ways, you know, Frank Wren obviously was the general manager when the contract was signed, but John Coppola was right there when that deal was structured as well. So, you know, I get it that they wanted to jump at the opportunity to get more arms. Coppy said the night of the trade, he said, hey, look, we're getting better offensively. For this year. Well, the interesting thing is this. Yes, Simmons ranked 130th out of 142 players, qualified players in OPS this year. One of those guys that ranked behind him was Eric Ibar. And I'm not sure that element, I agree with that element of the trade. And the one thing that's going to be interesting to watch is where does Simmons go from an offensive perspective the next few years? Because if this year was a sign that he is moving in the right direction, then this may end up being a trade that they regret.
Joe, I can't even really get a handle on what's going on with your club here lately, and that's even in the absence of major transactions. There's some really fascinating stuff going on here, and I kind of need to find ways to tie it all together. The thing that just popped just recently here as we were sort of, as I was prepping for this podcast, really, is a report that following up, there were rumors earlier that the Marlins would be interested, would entertain a trade of Jose Fernandez. And the idea was he may be about to get expensive. They're not quite there right yet. You can get an unbelievable bounty for him. Now there's a report just come out, I believe today, that essentially says this is not just about finance or about baseball, but that it's personal. There is discord between Fernandez and the front office. Is that your understanding? What's your read on this situation? Is this somebody kind of making a big deal out of a small deal? What's your understanding of this, that sort of personal relationship between Fernandez and the club?
Well, I think right now, and we talked a lot during the season about just how dysfunctional and awkward and, you know, the losing early in the year, the first half of the year was the train wreck and a huge mess. And most of the stuff that came out in the last day or two is pretty much very dated stuff that were incidents that happened before the July trade deadline. And, you know, clearly, you know, the team wasn't heading the right direction. There's a lot of crazy stuff going on. Players, not just Jose, yelled stuff that they wanted out of here in the clubhouse from time to time. So everything that I read, nothing there was anything past, you know, the end of July, early August. And, you know, we talked a lot towards the end under DJ, how they kind of pulled together. I think they were at 17-12 the last 29 games and played so much better and actually started looking like a team. So I think, you know, some of the reports that came out was old news, just kind of finding the light of day. Now, that said, you know, the comments made at the GM meetings of Scott Boras, where, you know, talking about Jose in innings and, you know, saying some things I wasn't pleased with how they handled the service time and the demotion of Marcell Ozuna, another of his clients, and that, you know, kind of tied into a response the AP got from David Sampson, who said Scott Boras will have nothing to do with anything Jose-related. So this kind of culture and climate has been kind of simmering. And, you know, I think one of the major reasons Don Mattingly is here is to basically buffer this, put an end to this, you know, buffer the front office from, you know, the players. I will say this, Jose Fernandez was very close with Dan Jennings. He liked DJ a lot, and he was almost, you know, he was considering going to the Alabama-LSU game, a game that DJ went to, and if not for weather, and Jared Cozart was going to go too, and Cozart at the time was, you know, negotiating his deal to, you know, to be with Scott Boras, so he didn't make it. So two Marlin players are going to be a tough loser for that football game and be part of, you know, hanging out with Dan Jennings. So the Marlins right now, Dan Jennings also was the link to Scott Boras. He was the guy who had the relationship. The Marlins right now need to find somebody, whether it's Mike Berger, Mike Hill, you know, somebody that tries to smooth things over, because there's been a David Sampson-Scott Boras kind of feud going back to Pudge Rodriguez after 03, when Pudge, the Marlins made a little bit of an attempt to sign Pudge in 04, and that obviously didn't work, and he went to Detroit. They just got to kind of get on the same page. I think it's a lot of nothing, you know, in terms of new news. It just kind of found a light of day, and things tend to take a life of its own. Everybody I talked to regarding Jose potentially being traded is like, slow news day. This is, you know, absolutely no truth. You know, the Miami Herald's hearing the same thing. Nobody in baseball is hearing any inclination that Jose is on the trade, you know, market. And typically, if a player of that caliber were, you know, if an organization is thinking of moving him, that stuff is discussed internally in October, and it comes out in the GM meetings, which you try to get as much value if you want to make it clear that, you know, Jose is out there. You're not going to let some of these other teams make trades of guys that potentially could be your fit to replace him. And quite frankly, they're not the Mets where they got three or four aces. They have Jose in the couple of threes and a couple of fives. You know, so they don't have a real, you know, if they want to rebuild again, you know, then you're trading Jose, and then many other pieces are following, because this team's going to take such a dramatic step backwards. I think any type of discord that there is between Jose and the front office is easily patched up. You know, he's 3 years away from free agency, so unless he just refuses to play and does an NFL-like player holdout, there's no reason to move him. You know, and on the flip side, and in fairness, you know, some of these comments are being made off the record by players who basically are poisoning the culture as much as supposedly Jose did. You know, if this is all dated stuff, Jose has been nothing but a great to the beat writers. He's been nothing but great to the city of Miami. He represents his team very well. His record shows that, and how he handles himself. Plus his background being, you know, from Cuba and the Cuban influence in South Florida. It's just kind of sad from my perspective to see so much of this and his, you know, this kind of almost smear campaign on him that, you know, kind of came out of, you know, a couple of radio guys who have kind of give this thing probably a lot more legs than it deserves.
I want to start with revisiting a topic that I've asked about a couple times because I think it's interesting. I'm the one who asks questions, but it sounds like you're getting it from Phillies fans as well. So I kind of want to revisit it one more time. And that is the idea that the Phillies clearly have money, and I don't think anybody thinks they're going to not spend for the long term. This is an organization that when it's ready to win is going to spend. I don't think anybody doubts that. But this is the best free agent class that anybody has seen in quite a few years, and likely to be the best one for a few years. And so it would seem to present an opportunity even for a team that is not really built to win in 2016. And so I just want to ask one more time, as the Phillies look at this market, and as the reality of the players available is sort of in front of them, and the reality of what might be available in future winters is in front of them, is there any notion, asking one more time, that they would take a dive in there, that they would be an aggressive player for, say, a power-hitting outfielder, say somebody like a Justin Upton or a front-of-the-rotation starter, anybody like that who wouldn't just be for 16, somebody you could add who would be a part of Phillies teams for a few years and presumably a contributing part of the next contending Phillies team?
Yeah, I really don't think so. I don't think the thinking on that has changed too much. I still think they look at this young core, you know, at the big league level. That's a group that includes Michael Franco, Aaron Nola, Odubel Herrera. In the minor leagues, you have some prospects like J.P. Crawford, Jake Thompson, Nick Williams, Jorge Alfaro, Andrew Knapp. I think there's so much kind of uncertainty around that group. They're very optimistic. They're hopeful. But in their mind, they just got out from underneath a lot of big contracts, and they're just not quite ready to take that plunge back into that free agency pool, the deep end of that free agency pool, and commit hundreds of millions of dollars to get an ace, to get a power-hitting outfielder, not knowing how the rest of those guys are going to kind of come together. You know, in a perfect world, all these guys turn out to be studs, and you have your core for the next, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, and you can sign Greinke or sign in Justin Upton, or whomever, and kind of go forward with those guys. But I think they just don't want to get caught in a situation where they invest a ton of money into a couple guys, and, you know, a couple of these pitchers suffer an injury. J.P. Crawford, for whatever reason, doesn't continue to develop like they had hoped. And next thing you know, you're sitting there going, oh, my God, we're right back to where we were in 2014, 2015, trying to trade some high-priced veterans who are now older, maybe less successful, maybe an injury risk. So I think they're going to continue to kind of do what they've done so far this offseason, which is acquire some bounce-back candidate type of guys to kind of fill that void for next season. And, you know, maybe 2017, but Jeremy Hellickson,
Dan Otero. They signed James Russell to a minor league contract. I think those types of guys are going to kind of be the guys that continue to get this offseason. Now, hey, they could surprise me and find somebody a little bit of an upper-tier type of player, but that big spend, I think, is going to be a year or two down the road.
I thought Hellickson was an interesting guy because he's not that far removed from being a rather good and very desirable starting pitcher. I mean, they only get him for 1 year, but do they view him as a guy with significant upside, or is it really just, yeah, he'll be fine, he'll be back in the rotation, he'll take the ball 30 times, and he won't get knocked around?
Yeah, I think they do view him as a guy with some upside. I don't know if they're expecting to necessarily go back to the way he was pitching a few years ago with the Rays, but I think they look at him as being different than what they did last offseason. Aaron Harang in his late 30s, Jerome Williams was kind of up and down, you know, ERAs in the fives. He had a good couple months with the Phillies, and so they signed him to a one-year extension. You know, Chad Billingsley coming off of multiple elbow injuries and elbow surgeries. They look at him and they say, oh, this guy's going to be 29 next year when he's pitching. So it's not like he's not in his mid-30s, late 30s, kind of at the tail end of his career. He's entering a free agent year. So they're kind of saying, hey, maybe this guy will get it together in the National League. I know he pitched last season with Arizona, but nevertheless, and pitching in the National League, youngish guy, free agent year, maybe all those stars will align, and he'll put together kind of a productive season. And I think most importantly, though, they view him as a guy that has a better chance of maybe making 30 starts than, you know, somebody last season like Williams or Harang. They just need somebody that they feel pretty confident health-wise, durability-wise, will be able to go out there and save some of these young arms in the bullpen, because a lot of those guys in the bullpen last year, I think, were really wearing down at the end of the season. And then I think they hope a guy like Hellickson can help prevent that.